She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And remember, we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And trust me when I say we are going to give you lots to think about for this show. Thank you for joining us. I want to be sure to mention that this show is sponsored by the Fairfax Companies, and we very much appreciate their support. My guest today is Greg Walcher. He is author of the book Smoking Them Out, The Theft of the Environment and How We Take It Back. Greg is also the founder of the Natural Resources Group, a consulting firm specializing in energy, water, public lands, forestry, and wildlife. And we are going to try to talk about everything that Greg touches in his consulting firm and in the book. We're going to talk a lot about the book, touch as many possible topics as we can fit in. Greg, welcome and thank you for being with us today.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Okay. And he said off air a little while ago, Greg loves live radio, so we're going to keep it lively. I have a short announcement about one of our national clients, Ecobella, and I'd like to do a call to action at the end of every show, and I do that. And what I'd like to do now is do a call to action at the start of the show, because I think safe cosmetics is an area about which we should all be concerned for many reasons, including our health and including the impact to the environment. Ecobella is a company that is always top of mind for me. Everything we buy and everything we put in our bodies has an environmental impact. And what I have said on the show many times, with Ecobella, not only is the impact minimized, but you know that what you're buying is healthier for you, and that's plain and simple. So I invite you to consider one small call to action today. Check them out at ecobella2c's.com and take all the worry out of making safe cosmetic choices. Okay, Greg, now we're going to get started, and I'm probably not going to take a deep breath till we're off the air. Why don't we start with a little bit of background about you and what motivated you to write the book? It is a content-rich book.
You're nice to say that, and I appreciate that. I've been working on issues related to conservation and natural resources and the environment all of my life, starting with my own background growing up as a fifth-generation native of Western Colorado, and with the love of the great outdoors and the hiking and fishing that my family did when I was little, and so on. So I've always had a kind of an inborn love of the great outdoors, as most Westerners have. I spent 10 years on Capitol Hill working on these issues for a Colorado senator. Then I went back to Western Colorado and ran a nonprofit group called Club 20, which represents the 20 counties west of the Continental Divide. It's sort of a big regional chamber of commerce and council of governments rolled into one, and they represent Western Colorado's unique interests as opposed to Denver or Washington, D.C. or California or wherever, fight for their fair share of highway funding and to keep Denver from taking all the water and worrying about the management of public lands and so on. I ran for Congress in 2004 and wound up in the top targeted House race in America that year, which wasn't quite what I expected. The huge amounts of money that get spent by outside groups these days and so forth. And I spent a number of years running the Colorado Department of Natural Resources as a member of the governor's cabinet, really in Colorado, as you can imagine, the largest state department outside of human resources that is in charge of wildlife and parks and water and forests and oil and gas and minerals and mining and public lands and all the fun stuff in state government, and I've been working on those issues as a consultant ever since. So I literally have spent my life working on issues related to endangered species and public lands and clean air and clean water and all the rest, and it just has always struck me that something is wrong in the way we deal with natural resources issues. And I don't know, one of the good ways to describe the frustration that I have felt over the years, and I know you have felt it as well as many of your listeners have, I have known a lot of the leaders of environmental organizations for a number of years, the national ones and at the state level, and these people are not dumb. They drive cars that burn oil. They live in houses made out of wood. God knows they use plenty of paper made from trees, and so it just doesn't seem possible that there are that many people who are that out of touch with reality that they think we don't need natural resources. And I've also known lots of people whose business was oil and gas and mining and minerals and timber and agriculture and water, and those people don't hate nature. They don't want to bulldoze the wilderness. In fact, some of the great outdoorsmen and nature lovers I've known in my life were loggers and miners. And so this nasty, angry, bitter, contentious, litigious, us-against-them climate that these issues have evolved into just never quite made sense to me. I've just thought for a number of years that something has gone badly off the rails in the way we deal with issues that we all care about. So that's what prompted me to write the book.
And the word uncivilized comes to mind. It's like we've just forgotten how to be civil. One of my very first very, very best favorite guests was the mayor of a town that was destroyed by a tornado, and they built the whole town back as an eco-friendly town. And he said, when did we forget to be civilized? It's such a good word. When did we forget to find some common ground? Because I believe you, we all do care about the environment. And I do want to read an intro statement. I told you off air when we talked a little bit ago that I'd like to put up on Facebook a picture of what your book looks like in my house, because it has about 400 little yellow stickies and pink stickies and green stickies. Talk to him about that. But right in your intro statement, which to me, when you're writing a book, you either have them from Hello or not. And you did. You grabbed me. So here's what you said. No nation has ever purposely burned down food supply, yet that is precisely what the United States government is now doing by subsidizing ethanol production at the expense of higher grocery prices, supposedly to save us from the evils of fossil fuels. Why did you decide to come out of the chute with that one? I mean, there's lots of sticks of dynamite in there. It got me. I'm like, yeah, why is that? So why did you pick that in, like, it's in the first or second paragraph, I think, of the intro?
It is part of a in context, though, part of a list of things that
yes.
say to me that we have become the first society in the history of the world that is adopting policies that will ensure our own decline.
Yes.
And it's bizarre. It's weird. There are all kinds of other issues that are often contentious. That isn't particularly unique. But this is different. This is new. When you think about the fact that every generation in the history of mankind has always wanted their kids to have it better than they did, and yet we now have become a society that is adopting policies designed to try and encourage the next generation to have a lower standard of living, literally to travel less, especially, live in smaller houses that are less comfortable, to stop producing and consuming especially, manufacturing, to get people to give up their cars and other modern conveniences. It's a very bizarre thing, and we're doing it on purpose and under the guise of a strange theory that free enterprise is evil, that profit is selfish, and especially that our pursuit of the good life is somehow destroying the environment around us, if not the very earth itself, and that we've got to stop it. And that is part of what has led to the sort of ugliness in the environmental movement.
But isn't there a piece of this where like what motivates me is I would rather get 51 miles per gallon because of the price of gasoline. And I would rather, we live in a very big house, our electric bill is considerable. So to me, it's not anything against private enterprise or the growth of our economy in positive ways, but I'm motivated by, I think there can be a triple bottom line if you live a more sustainable life. I mean, it might be greedy on my part that I want to have a car that gets 51 miles per gallon and is clean burning.
No, I don't think it's greedy at all. I think that's common sense, and I want the same thing, and so do most Americans. You're not part of the problem that I'm talking about. What has occurred to me, though, and I've mentioned it in some detail in the section on endangered species, because it's as good an aha moment as there is to try and figure out exactly what's gone wrong. In the Colorado Department of Natural Resources, we undertook a project to recover the endangered species in our state so they could be taken off the endangered list. We built a hatchery to raise the endangered fish. We brought back links into the high country. We recovered by reestablishing in the wild populations of river otter and desert bighorn sheep and moose and all kinds of other previously extirpated or endangered species. And the most remarkable thing about these great conservation success stories is that the federal agencies in charge of them and the environmental organizations that were part of those roundtables were opposed to it. And when you talk about taking a species that is endangered, which is a threat to the biodiversity that we all value about the West, and you want to recover it so it can be taken off the endangered list, and environmental organizations are opposed to it, you cannot escape the conclusion that there's some other agenda there other than the environment. And it's true all the way across the board when you look at what's happening to our national forests, what's happening in energy policy, in clean air and water, in wetlands, and a whole range of discussions that involve environmental organizations. People wind up having this frustration that somehow these environmental laws are being used against people rather than for the environment. And it just seems kind of upside down and backwards to a lot of people, and they're right.
But you were part of seeing it in action, which to me gives you a lot of credibility. And let's talk about, I love some of the stories, and I think it would be helpful for listeners to tell a couple of the stories, because then I think they're going to want to go out and buy your book, which I'm personally promoting. But when you're talking about recovering endangered species, will you tell the story about the Upper Colorado River fish? Because it's a great story. People like stories. It makes it relatable. It was 4 agencies, 3 states, 6 nonprofits, which is scary already. So what happened in that whole Upper Colorado River fish endangered fish recovery program?
Well, the program is still very, very much underway, and it's of great interest in Arizona as well, because it's one of the 7 states whose 30 million people depend on water from the Colorado River. And so the declaration that these 4 fish species were endangered was a horrendous shot across the bow to people all over the West, because the Endangered Species Act, as you well know, is one of the most powerful laws that Congress ever passed. And it literally, when some species is declared endangered, it kicks in a whole body of law that trumps all other federal and state
laws. Yeah, and just watch
laws.
Out.
And it sends fear and terror and loathing into the hearts of landowners and others who depend on the resource where the endangered species is located. And so the declaration that there are 4 fish in the Upper Colorado River, the razorback sucker, bony-tailed chub, humpback chub, and Colorado River pike minnow, that were declared endangered, and one of them, the humpback chub, extinct in the Upper Colorado River. And so the Endangered Fish Recovery Program was created actually quite a few years ago now. When I first started in the governor's cabinet and we decided to take a different approach on this issue, that was our sort of lead issue, because the program had been underway for 10 years. It had spent $100 million of taxpayers' money.
It's so egregious.
Without any goals ever having been established, without anybody ever saying where the light is at the end of the tunnel, and in the case of the questions I was asking, how many fish are there supposed to be? At what point will we decide whether they've been recovered or not? Because, frankly, the recovery isn't that difficult. We can do, all of the states have the ability to protect in-stream flows and to protect habitat. All of them have done that. The federal government has spent lots of money doing the same thing. They've built fish passages around all the dams in the Colorado River. There are recovered wetlands and flooding ponds where those fish tend to spawn. All of that habitat work was done. But at some point, somebody has to put humpback chubs back into the river or they're still going to be extinct. And so that's what we wanted to do. And I was a member, just because of the position that I held under the statutes, I was a member of the governing committee of that program. And so I started off my first meeting when they wanted to talk about reauthorizing the program, which was going to expire at some point, and I started saying, well, I want to talk about recovery goals for the fish so we'll know what the criteria is to get it off the endangered list. And it was the most bizarre 6 or 8 month long set of meetings that I've ever been into in my life, where, you know, with federales insisting that there was no possible way to publish recovery goals. And I just had, you know, simple questions like, how many fish did there used to be? We have no idea. Well, how many fish should there be? We have no idea. And I started saying, well, how do you know if they're endangered if you don't know how many there ever were? Some species have always been rare, but somebody must have some clue how common they were and what the current river, how the current river population compares to that. Well, no, they didn't. And so we started saying, well, you're going to have to publish recovery goals, or this one state won't agree to the reauthorization of the program. It was a joint effort of federal agencies and state governments. And so we had the ability to sort of force the issue and insist on it. But it was so strange that at one point, after months of angry meetings, they even brought in lawyers at one point to assure us that what we were talking about was illegal. We were literally saying, if you don't have the budget and the staff to put together recovery goals, which was what they were saying, then we at the state level would be glad to do it for you. We have plenty of wildlife biologists on the state payroll, including some of the world's foremost experts in those fish, so we'll do that. Well, they said, that's illegal. You can't have a state doing federal things. And, you know, it went on and on like that until at one point they finally said to me, what do you think the recovery goals ought to be? And I just said, well, the goal ought to be to recover the fish, take them off of the endangered list, and abolish this program. And I said, if anybody has a different goal than that, I think they ought to stand up and tell us what it is. And the most amazing thing happened all the way around the room to a person. Everybody started saying, well, yes, of course, absolutely. That's what we all think the goal is. And it just sort of occurred to me in that moment that if anybody has some other agenda, and this is sort of one of the main theses of my book, it's hard for them to stand up in public and admit it. You know, no one's going to stand up in front of a crowded room full of people and say, you know, I don't care about those fish. I just wanted to control all the water and thereby limit growth in the West. Or, you know, I don't care about the lynx. I just wanted to close the roads and ban snowmobiles and stop logging and stop grazing. Whatever it is, if there's some other agenda, they can't really admit to it. And so my theory is we need to make the environment the main issue. Do the right thing, which in this case is recover the endangered species. That's what the Act was intended to do all along. And if somebody's against it, let them explain to the public why.
And you have, you know, this is when I wish I had a video stream so people could see the notes I went, because what you wanted to me was so outrageous. You wanted goals that were measurable, enforceable, and will be attained. And I put, wow, that is really not so much to ask. I mean, it was just, there were lots of times when I was talking out loud while I was reading your book. So the federal government, in this case, they officially argued, as you said, that the reintroduced species, didn't they say something about they're not genetically the same as the wild ones? I mean,
it's absurd. I mean, we literally had some of the nation's top experts in these fish that are professional wildlife biologists that work for the state Game and Fish Department. There's no chance that these are our bad scientists who are going to get this wrong, and the federal government tried to make that claim, but they couldn't make it stick because it wasn't accurate.
How would you compare that, the whole reintroduction piece? I wanted to ask you that because this is ridiculous. We've covered one topic and we're 16 minutes into the show, and I have so much I want to ask you. But when you talk about overcoming fear and information, you alluded to it a little bit, but the lynx story is one worth telling before we go to break. And I think it's the same thing as the the gray wolf. There's so much information out there and fear, and people get up in arms, but they really don't know what they're talking about.
Well, they certainly didn't with respect to the lynx, they meaning the U.S. Forest Service. We reintroduced the lynx in Colorado, even though they had almost never lived there. The grand total of lynx ever documented in the history of the state was only 18. So it was never a big part of the migratory range of an animal that is quite common in Alaska and Canada and so on. But in spite of that, there was an order from the National Office of the Forest Service to all of the national forests in the state to rewrite all of their management plans to accommodate a species that wasn't there. And it was being used as a tool to stop, literally, to close the roads and stop, you know, ban snowmobiles and stop grazing and stop logging and stop oil and gas exploration and stop this and stop that. The discussion was everything in the world other than the lynx itself. So we started saying, well, lynx are endangered because they have pretty fur. It's not because we've done anything to their habitat, but our ancestors trapped them, and so now they're gone. But they live above, you know, 10,000 feet elevation, and so we haven't done anything to that habitat, so you don't have to do much about it other than bring them back and put them out there and not kill them. And their population predictably recovered just fine. It is another of the great success stories in conservation in the West. The lynx population is fully self-supporting and self-sustaining in Colorado today. But the federal government still won't take them off the endangered list because that doesn't fit with the agenda, which is about land management, not about the lynx.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. I am having the pleasure of interviewing Greg Walcher, who's author of the book, Smoking Them Out, The Theft of the Environment and How to Get It Back. When we come back, more on healthy forests, water in the West, and climate change. Please stay here with me.
Can you predict the future? The reality is we can't, but we can be ready for it. Funded by the National Science Foundation, researchers at the University of Arizona are working on a $3 million project to study the monsoon and learn about our changing desert weather, climate, and ecology. Such knowledge will help guide us to a more sustainable future, not just for our desert, but for the world. Now that's thinking ahead. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Hi there, this is Mrs. Green. Fuel efficiency is picking up speed thanks to the new 48 turbocharged miles per gallon Volkswagen Jetta Hybrid. When you hear numbers like 48 highway miles per gallon and 42 city miles per gallon, you might think the Jetta Hybrid is more about fuel efficiency than fun. But for all its good looks and eco-responsibility, this Jetta gets its power from a turbocharged engine capable of 170 horsepower. And when you experience its ultra-fast 7-speed DSG automatic transmission, you'll realize that the Jetta has a lot more going on under the hood than your average hybrid. Yes, this new Jetta is quick and fun to drive, but it's still got the incredible efficiency you'd expect from a hybrid. How fuel efficient is it? Well, all you need to do is look, because each VW hybrid shows your energy usage and driving range on its touchscreen display. When you see how much fuel you're saving, you'll be pleasantly surprised by how economical this little speed demon can be. Please visit Chapman Volkswagen at 4500 East 22nd Street in Tucson or chapmantucson.com to find out more.
You can always find things around the house to give to Goodwill, but I have a bigger reason to give. My brother, Jim. When Jim was just 6 weeks old, he had a stroke. He had to rewire his brain to do most things we all take for granted. Thanks to Goodwill, Jim has a job and a sense of purpose. You know how they say your donation to Goodwill changes lives? Well, it's true. Goodwill is the best thing that ever happened to Jim. Please donate today.
Bookman Sports Exchange is now open at 3330 East Speedway. We're taking our passion and experience of buying, selling, and trading books and music and applying it to the world of sporting goods, outdoor, and fitness gear. We are giving you another way to save money on the things that you love, Bookman style. Remember, Bookman Sports Exchange, sporting goods, outdoor, and fitness gear, now open daily from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. on Speedway east of Country Club. Check out bookmans.com for more info.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to, and we are giving you lots to think about today. I am pleased to have as my guest Greg Walcher. He is the author of the book, Smoking Them Out, The Theft of the Environment and How to Take It Back. I personally strongly recommend it. He tells a great story in addition to providing a lot of scientific information that will make us think. Greg is also the president of the Natural Resources Group, a consulting firm that specializes in energy, water, public lands, forestry, and wildlife. And we are covering enough topics, but it's never going to be enough for me, Greg. So let's get on with it. We talked about endangered species. Let's move on to restoring healthy forests, if that's okay with you.
That's great. It's an issue that affects vast segment of the West, from Arizona and New Mexico to the north end of British Columbia.
It's a really big topic, and as I said to you, and everybody that listens to me knows, it became up close and personal for us with the mega fire that we had here, the Wallow Fire that destroyed about 1 million ponderosa pines. So it really is unbelievable. Okay, one of your quotes: "Men argue, nature acts." Voltaire. Why this quote? Are we sitting around arguing what to do about the national forests and about forestry lands and not acting enough?
We are, and we're arguing about the wrong things, which is even more to the point. We argue with respect to public lands discussions, we always argue about the tools that ought to be used rather than what we want the landscape to look like at the end of the process. And to me, It's very much like trying to put together a picture puzzle without the benefit of the picture on the box top. If you don't know what it's supposed to look like when you're done, you're never going to get there. And that is literally what we do with forests. We argue about how much money we ought to spend on fire suppression. We argue about how many billion board feet of timber ought to be cut. We argue about the importance of a dying timber industry to various communities that are dependent for their jobs. We argue about saving people's houses that built them in the red zone, about protecting the little money that Congress does appropriate for the forest health dilemma gets spent, mostly protecting power lines and campgrounds and roads and trails and so on. But we're never going to get to the restoration of a healthy forest that way. The discussion shouldn't be the health of the timber industry or the safety of people's homes. It ought to be the health of the forest. And of course, today we're a long ways away from that. And so the result of that is that we have squandered in our generation one of the greatest legacies of the conservation movement, which is the beautiful national forests that today are dead and dying, falling down, and rotting and burning up at an unbelievable rate that is in no way connected with nature. We've lost 68 million acres to forest fires in the last 10 years. We've got the Forest Service now says 90 million acres all across the West are either dead or at risk of catastrophic wildfires. That is an area bigger than New York, New Jersey, and all of New England combined.
We're sitting around arguing about the details
rather than getting out there and fixing the forest.
You know, you wrote in the book about the invasion of the bark beetle, which is something we have never seen in the history of nature. Can you expand on the devastating effects? I mean, that is not anything man-caused. I mean, that's one of the reasons why things were so bad when the wildfire started. You had hundreds of thousands of dead trees sitting around that were literally destroyed by the bark beetle.
Well, that is absolutely true, but it is not true that man isn't responsible for it. What's happened in the forest is that we have allowed this gigantic overgrowth to occur where lodgepole pine and ponderosa pine forests that normally in a natural state would have, say, 50 trees per acre, now have 900 to 1,000 trees per acre, plus all the brush and grasses and other things that build up when you don't have either natural fires, which we suppressed for 100 years, or any kind of logging and thinning, which we have suppressed for the last generation or so. The result of that is that we've sort of built a wall around the forest and declared them off limits to everything, and it's an absolute death sentence to the forest, including the growth of the bark beetles, which are a direct result of that overgrowth and the tree's inability to produce enough of its natural defenses because it can't get enough water. So there is a direct connection between our lack of management of the forest and this, as you say, completely unnatural outbreak of beetles and of fires. And so the result of it is dead and dying forests all over the West. And I'm not interested, by the way, so much in assessing blame. People make decisions based on what they thought was the best available information at the time. I'm not upset about that. What I'm upset about is that we're not doing anything about it in the last few years when we have understood what needs to be done. That's why I keep talking about what I call hands-on environmentalism that we need to take on every step of the way. In the case of the forests, while we're sitting around arguing, someone needs to be out there restoring the forest. So my way of thinking about that is simply to say, like recovering endangered fish requires a hatchery, not a government regulation, well, restoring healthy forests requires a chainsaw, not a committee. Creating energy independence requires producing energy, not arguing in Congress about a 50-year energy plan. And all the way across the board, we have these political arguments underway while no one is doing anything actually on the ground to restore a clean and healthy environment that we can all be proud of.
And then we spend the money on fire suppression. I mean, it's like, okay, there's no prevention, but then we spend the money because the fires have started and it threatens homes, and so the money does get spent, but it doesn't get spent on the right end of it.
During this most recent government shutdown where forest fire fighting was considered an essential activity and therefore not shut down, and all activity relating to stewardship contracts and timber contracts and sales and all the rest were all shut down as non-essential activities, which is the same as saying we think it's crucial that we put out the fires, but it's not particularly important whether we prevent them.
So what do you say, I mean, I've had lots of guests on my show with different perspectives on this. What would your response be to someone that says, it's just as simple as letting nature take its course and we should let the forest be? What would your response to that be, other than look at what's happened? How's that working for us?
Well, I might say that, but I would just begin by saying that these catastrophic fires we're seeing are not natural. They're not even close to natural.
In
a state of nature, lightning would strike every 5 or 10 years or so and burn out all the little stuff in the bottom of the forest floor. It kills all the little trees, takes out all the brush and grasses and so on. You can tell exactly how often that's happened by studying old tree rings, and yeah, that would not be possible if it killed the tree. But in these fires now, with this massive overgrowth of the fuel loads, as they call it, the result is fires that grow into the crown of the trees and literally destroy 90% of everything in their path. There's nothing natural about that.
And it's to me, like in Arizona, and that's my most, the area about which I'm most knowledgeable, there was and still continues to be great controversy because the reservation land did not burn as much. And a lot of that is because they do logging and they do clearing. So the national forest that, you know, abutted our property, it was thick and it was lots of felled trees and it was a tinderbox, and you know, in the
right.
time of drought. So it was clearly
examples of that all over the West where the fire line just sort of stopped when it got to the forest that had been managed after burning completely the forest that had been unmanaged. And it's just tragic to see that. I've walked across, you know, in Colorado in 2002 when I was heading the Department of Natural Resources there, we had the worst fire season in the state's history. The four biggest fires in state history were all burning at the same time. I've walked across landscapes afterwards where the fire was so hot that it literally melted the soil into glass and it would crunch under your feet. Some of your listeners may have had similar experience. There's no way that the trees or anything else can grow back through that. It's destroyed not only trees, but also wildlife, including endangered species, for generations that'll never be back again. It's just a horrible, horrible tragedy, and we shouldn't be sitting around arguing about whether or not to act. We ought to be arguing about what's the right way to do that, and so the right discussion should be how to do this right. I would acknowledge, of course, that there have been abuses and mistakes in management of forests in the past. But to adopt these nationwide one-size-fits-all slogans like, oh, you know, save the old growth. Well, that sounds great in the sequoias in California, but aspen trees only live 100 years, and then
right.
they die.
It's no old
and
growth.
So there isn't any old growth in parts of the West that we're talking about, and the theory just doesn't fit there. Clear-cutting is required for some species and absolutely not allowable in others. And so we ought to be talking about how to do this right rather than arguing about whether to act at all.
And then you have, you know, you call in your book, and I loved it because I think you have a great sense of humor as well, analysis paralysis. While we're sitting around, just expand on that a little bit. Everybody's sitting around analyzing all the data, and the forests are literally not, they are burning, and they're getting ready. I mean, the West is ready to go up in smoke. That's how I walk around feeling most days. Like, we're just waiting.
Government's first reaction to everything is to do a study, of course. I wish I could claim credit for the term analysis paralysis. It was originated by a former chief of the Forest Service, Dale Robertson, but it's exactly what's wrong. We study things to death and we argue about the study, and so then we need another study, you know, while the forest is dying and falling down and rotting and burning up.
That chapter in the book didn't give me a lot of hope because you talked about things like the Forest Service budget is not necessarily needing to be increased. It needs to be reorganized and restructured. And I really get pretty frustrated with the lack of seeing that happen in my lifetime. Do you have hope that something like your book and people getting really aggravated about this will help end the paralysis? I mean,
Well, there's no doubt that the aggravation is already there. We live in a system that is motivated by public opinion as intended. So when people get angry enough about it that they demand a different approach to it, we will see that. And I have a lot of hope about that. I think this is a very resilient country that we live in, and we can get over almost anything. But it is a tragedy for us to squander the great conservation legacies in the way that we're doing out there, and we need to get on with it.
And we're living at a time, I mean, I've had guests on my show that talk about things like nature deficit disorder, that they're thinking about making clinical diagnosis because kids need to get out in nature And when they do that with their parents, it gets you so alive with what is so worth preserving. That's my passionate plea. It's like, we really have to hurry up, folks, and get engaged and get involved, because these forests are worth saving. And in our land, I mean, it'll never be restored to what it was like for decades. I mean, certainly not in my
generation. I do wish we could return a lot of these discussions and issues to the curriculum of the public schools. When I was in elementary school, we had field trips out to the forest. We had a field trip to the local water treatment plant, where we learned all about the role that reservoirs and pipelines play. And so none of that is in the curriculum anymore. And so we wind up with this deficit of what kids learn in schools about where things come from, basic things in their day-to-day lives. That I used to go and talk to classrooms of kids once in a while when I was at the Natural Resources Department. I talked to a third-grade class that was in the heart of this area where there was a big controversy about gold mining, and I asked them, what is gold used for? And they all said jewelry. And I said, do you think you could live without it if you had to? And, you know, they acknowledged that if they had to, they guessed they probably could. And I said, what if I told you can't make a computer without gold? Do you think you could live without that? And, of course, none of them thought they could live without that. And if they understood the need for natural resources in our lives and what it takes to manufacture, you know, a desk, a pencil, a car, a house,
a refrigerator,
computer, all the things in their day-to-day lives, yeah, they'd have a different view of natural resources than,
yeah,
they have.
We need them, and people don't even realize. I mean, I think we put about $60 million of gold and silver in the landfills just in cell phones, some ridiculous statistic like that. Well, I want to talk about one chapter in your book in particular, because it goes back to the fear factor. Everybody loves the polar bear, and you dedicated an entire chapter on polar bears and their planet, and that scares us. I mean, the general public. It's like, oh, we need our polar bears. We can't destroy the habitat of the polar bears. And I, of course, am a big fan of the movie Ice Age, and I know the woolly mammoth is not here anymore, but talk about, to me, it's like facing the fears, getting facts, letting facts get in the way. So can you talk a little bit about that chapter? It was one of my favorites.
Well, thanks. I love polar bears, too. And there is, by the way, a substantial body of science that indicates that the death of the woolly mammoth may have been caused, at least in part, by another period of global warming in the past. These global cycles do change, and the only thing that's absolutely clear to me is that we don't understand it nearly well enough. You know, there's lots of people who want to claim that the contributions of man to global warming is absolute settled science and there's no need for any further debate. And as I try to point out, that is an offensive notion to actual scientists. There's no, in real science, there's no such thing as settled science. And I just, you know, remind people that that our past is full of all kinds of colorful examples of settled science that turned out to be discredited by further study later on.
Yeah, it's not static. I mean, it's dynamic. It's constantly.
Well, Galileo spent the rest of his life in prison or on house arrest after endorsing Copernicus's view that the sun was at the center of the universe, because it was such a radical view at the time, and everyone thought it was settled science. You know, scientists used to think that bad air was the cause of all diseases until they discovered bacteria. So, there isn't such a thing to me as settled science and a time when we're just going to say, there, we no longer need to study this at all. That would just be plain silly in my view. We do know that the globe, that the climate does change from time to time. We know that it's warmer by some increment than it was a century ago. There isn't, I don't think, a lot of question about that. But there's a lot of question about what caused it. We know that it happened coincident to a large growth in the population of people and to the growth in our use of fossil fuels. I don't know that it's necessarily proven that the one caused the other, but clearly they happened at the same time. But we also know that there's been all kinds of phony science pushed by people with a political agenda. The hockey stick comes to mind, for example, which we now know is completely phony. And we know that some predictions regarding global warming have turned out to be wrong. So to me, it all just says clearly, we need two things. We need to study it very much more carefully than we have and try to understand it better than we have, and we need to quit polluting the air in various places where we do that. That does not mean, however, that we need to stop producing and consuming altogether. It doesn't even mean that we need to lower our standard of living and stop using energy. It just means that we need to always focus the debate on doing the right thing for the environment and on trying to get it right.
And when we come back, we have another break to do, but I would like you to talk a little bit about how you fit that into the discussion of the polar bears and their planet, Everybody, we're listening to Greg Walcher. He is the author of the book, Smoking Them Out, The Theft of the Environment, How to Get It Back. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the polar bear, touch on water, because it's such a big, huge issue, the things we're going to do about water, alternative energy, if we have time, and global warming. And the last question I'd like to ask in the segment is, what are we going to do about it? How do we end the political divisiveness and get on a path that's for the good of all concerned? Please stay here with me. We'll be right back. You're listening to Mrs. Green's World Radio Network.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Mrs. Green's World is a proud member of the Dream Vision 7 and Castle Rock Radio Networks. If you have questions about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green's World next.
Hi there, this is Mrs. Green. The 2013 VW Jetta TDI is the sedan people love to love. It comes with a zippy turbocharged diesel engine that's 90% cleaner burning than previous diesel engines, and it goes farther on a tank of gas than a Toyota Prius. Chapman Volkswagen has a great selection of Jetta TDIs, so choose yours today at ChapmanTucson.com or in person at 4646 East 22nd Street in Tucson.
Can academic research really save the planet? This year, the University of Arizona took full ownership of Biosphere 2. With five ecosystems enclosed in over 7 million cubic feet of sealed glass, Biosphere 2 is a premier facility for environmental research, where the top minds in the world will come together to address some of humanity's greatest challenges, such as climate change. Now that's using your brains. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Did you know that even a donated doorknob can help Habitat for Humanity? Habitat's Habitstore accepts donated items like furniture, building materials, and appliances. Donations come from commercial builders, malls, restaurants, hotels, and individuals like you. Then, items are bought by bargain hunters who come across the very things they are looking for, just like the right doorknob. The best part is that Habitstore sales generate funds for building homes. Call 520-889-7200 or visit HabitatTucson.org.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to, and hopefully we are giving you lots to think about today. My guest is Greg Walcher. He is author of the book, Smoking Them Out, The Theft of the Environment and How to Take It Back. And I think there are lots of us that would really like to join Greg in that plea. How do we get it back? Greg is also the president of the Natural Resources Group, a consulting firm that specializes in energy, water, public lands, forestry, and wildlife. And all I can tell you people is he's got cred. He had instant cred when I did his background. So it's like, let's listen to a lot of what this man has to say, because he does have a very positive focus on the future. Greg, thanks for being with us.
Oh, so, thank you. I appreciate your, I hope you'll be forgiven for your shameless exaggeration. I appreciate the plug.
No, I don't do that. It's like, no, you have to look and see all the things this man's done, and you do let facts get in the way. That's one of my favorite things I say to people. Well, yeah, you know, you need to let a little bit of facts get in the way. And is it fair to say that the what you're asking for in the chapter about the polar bear is just close and careful study of the actual data, the facts, should govern what our scientific conclusions become? I find that most scientists that I interview do that. They really do study the science, they do study the facts, and they come to some great conclusions, which are summarily ignored in many cases.
Well, we need to do that. And the other thing we need to do is separate the politics from it. There's so much of the argument over global warming and over polar bears and so on is more about politics than it is about science. And I think that's really unfortunate, because it prompts people to propose policies that just flat won't help the environment in any way. I know there a lot of the climate change discussion all over the world, in parliaments and in legal bodies especially, is all about taxes and carbon rules and things that are all about moving money around. They're not about changing the environment in any appreciable way, unless somebody thinks that we're going to make people in China and India give up their quest for the automobile. Nothing that we do is going to really change that on any kind of an immediate basis if we just do, you know, something in Arizona. We've got to keep the big picture foremost in mind. And this whole discussion about transferring wealth from one part of the world to another part of the world is, in my view, perfectly legitimate discussion. If somebody thinks the United States is too rich and that we ought to transfer a lot of money to poorer countries around the world, I think that's fine. Bring it on. Let's have that debate. But it's not about polar bears, because if it's about polar bears, then my approach is, let's make it about polar bears then. How many are there supposed to be? What's their habitat supposed to look like? Because that we can do. That is a doable thing. Convincing a billion people in the Far East that they should never, ever own a car, we're not going to do that.
We're
fixing
not.
The habitat of polar bears and making sure there are plenty of them, we can do. So my whole thing is, when you're in an environmental debate, make sure you're in the right debate. Let's first talk about exactly what it is that we're trying to accomplish, because then we've got the picture on the box top, on the jigsaw puzzle box, and we can figure out how to get there. And frankly, I just think there is a huge vacuum for leadership now in the conservation movement worldwide, and this is kind of the main reason for the title of the book, about the theft of the environment. We've evolved to this point where the environmental lobby is so giant, so huge, and so powerful. I mean, corporations and foundations are giving to environmental organizations at the rate of $9 million a day, and they're filing environmental lawsuits three times a day all over the United States. It's a massive worldwide industry of environmental organizations, and at the same time that they have reached the pinnacle of success in terms of size and staff and budgets and expertise and lawyers and so on, the whole movement has kind of become sort of intellectually bankrupt at the same time. And by that I mean that it doesn't have any good answers for the real environmental issues that we face. How to supply the natural resources that it takes to build a prosperous economy in a way that can be sustainable and responsible and that we can bounce grandkids on our knees and be proud of someday, that's a challenge. That's exciting. That's what we ought to be all about. Instead of all of these kind of phony, false issues that we seem to get caught up in. And it's the reason people are so frustrated about the environment, because we all care about it, we all love the great outdoors, and we all feel a personal responsibility to leave it better than we found it. And yet it just doesn't seem like what we're doing. It seems like we're suing each other all the time instead. So that's what the book is about.
And I'm not sure everybody thinks they're about leaving the place better than when they found it. I would like to believe that they do. But I think of two examples in terms of big organizations that are dedicated to the environment. One is Oceana. I've had Ted Danson and Andy Sharpless on my show. And to me, it's one of the ones, it's an organization that I support, because what I see is results. They're doing things about making sure that there is a fish food supply. I think they've provided me with enough data and scientific support for that. So there are organizations that aren't necessarily just fighting, but there are many of them that are. You're right, they're involved in lawsuits. So do you have any examples in your experience of organizations that we should be getting behind that really do have a focus on the future?
Well, I do, and we probably all know organizations that we think are more trustworthy than others. I mentioned in the book, for example, the huge growth of the land trusts in recent years,
right,
because most people really, really like that, because they put their money where their mouth is. Instead
right.
of trying to use some new endangered species you've never heard of as a way to regulate your property, if they want to save the open space, they go out and buy it, and that's the way it ought to work in a free market system like ours. And so there are a lot more people joining those now than, you know, joining the older, more traditional environmental organizations that don't do anything but file lawsuits and try to stop everything. You know, if the whole answer to any environmental problem you face is stop something, that's no good answer, because it doesn't supply the resources that you need for the economy. So I keep saying, let's put our money where our mouth is. Let's take the bull by the horns and do what I call hands-on environmentalism. Let's build hatcheries and get out and restore the forest. This is all on-the-ground work that requires private investment. It doesn't really require government regulations and legislation and lawsuits and ballot initiatives and all of that. It just requires people to care enough to get out and do the right thing, and for the political system and legal system to let them do that without the regulatory hammer that is so often used instead.
Let's stop fighting. I know it's like there was something in your book that you talk about polarizing. Let's stop polarizing. And I said, let's start mobilizing. Let's segue to water, because I live in the Southwest, and it's a huge issue. And one of the things that in the notes that I read, it said the Western states must capture and store their limited water supply during the months when the snow is melting and running towards the oceans. Well, we've had here in Arizona a very, very dry monsoon. We didn't have water to capture. I have no idea what's going to happen for the snow in the mountains in the winter. But what if we don't have the opportunity in the Southwest to store the limited supply because it's getting more limited? What are some of your thoughts?
Well, we do have that option, and it may not always be in Arizona. Arizona is dependent in large part on water that falls originally in Colorado.
We are so absolutely dependent on
that. That's the reason we have these interstate compacts that regulate the water. I was involved for almost a decade in the negotiations with California to limit its intake of the Colorado River, part of which was caused by the need for that was caused by the construction, finally, of the Central Arizona Project, which meant that Arizona had finally grown into its entire allotted share of the river. And the rapid growth of Las Vegas during the 80s and 90s meant that Nevada grew into its entire share of the river. So California desperately needs to be able to limit its share of the river as well, because the river doesn't have the water in it that it once had. And you cannot separate that discussion from the other one we had earlier about public lands. This massive overgrowth of vegetation on the land is largely responsible for it. And it isn't just with the trees and brush in the national forest, but also these non-native species like tamarisk, which has lined a lot of the Colorado River and most of its tributaries now in the upper basin, and which consumes probably the entire missing million acre feet of water a year. So if we could restore the landscape to what it's supposed to be, there would be enormously more water in the river system to begin with. And so my point is we should be studying that too, but on the ground we need to be doing that and restoring that situation, because you're living in the fastest growing part of the United States, and in a free society we can't keep people from moving where they want to live in great places like that. And so we've got to be able to supply the resources that they're going to need. And so water conservation is at the absolute heart of everything in the arid West. You know, when you touch water, you touch everything out there.
And people, I mean, when you watch people, some of the mega millionaires, they're buying water rights. I mean, it's a very hot real estate investment right now. It's like, yeah, where can I get more water rights? And that's, you know, to me, that's of concern. It's like very, really smart people are out there buying the water rights. So do you think I should plan to move out of Tucson, Arizona, maybe head a little bit up north?
But I think you should stay involved in the water discussion, because we do have the ability to conserve water better than we do in the West, and we have the ability to store a lot more of it than we do in the West, and we've made water storage fairly unpopular because of our aversion as a people to dams. But dams are only one of many, many ways that we can store additional water and conserve the water that we have. There's all sorts of places, for example, where you can store water underground so that you're not interrupting the flow of rivers and causing problems with fish and other habitat. There's a lot of ways to do water exchanges back and forth within the legal limits of the interstate compacts. We can do a lot, and we've pioneered a number of ways in Colorado, Arizona, and New Mexico for doing that, and there's lots of great successes out there too. So I encourage people to read a lot more about it. It's a complicated set of issues, but it is enormously important to everything that we do in the environment.
It's the one thing that we can't live without. And, you know, I've had Robert Glennon on my show, and I have a lot of respect for him. And he's an internationally recognized expert on water. And for Tucson, for example, if we just figured out a way, like you talked about water storage, to capture whatever rainfall we do get during the monsoon, he has proven over and over again by studying the volume of rain that comes down that it would be enough water to serve the whole Pima County for the year if we figured out a way to use it. So your point is very well taken. Time is going to fly, and I don't want to be rushed, but I'd love to talk to a little bit more about you make a strong statement on energy. Let's segue into energy, that we have everything we need to end our dependence on unreliable foreign governments. Expand on that a little bit, and I didn't see much in the book, and maybe I missed some of it on, yes, we have a lot of oil and gas in this country, but should we not be looking for other sources of clean energy? So answer the first one, the first part.
Well, it's one the answer, of,
it's my
the
long
answer to
question.
All of those is, the answer to all of them is yes, yes, and yes.
Okay.
We ought to be, even if you discount the growth of renewable energy, which I'm not willing to do because, like most Americans, I support that, and I think we ought to be investing further in creating energy from hydropower and wind and solar and geothermal and, you know, all of the other biomass, the other sources that we can. I think we should be doing all of the above. But as I point out in the book, we say at the federal level that we're pursuing an all of the above strategy, when in fact we're pursuing a none of the above strategy, and it's not working. We have the energy in this country that our nation needs. There isn't any question about that. We have more oil in the Piance Basin alone than in the entire known reserves of the world. We've made a conscious decision as a society to wall off a lot of the energy in our own country, and in order to remain dependent on foreign countries. That may be, there may be people out there who think that's a good idea and who think that's wise policy. I don't happen to think so. But it's a legitimate debate. It's just like all the rest of it, though. It needs to be based on correct information and on sound science. And to begin the discussion with an understanding that we're running out of oil is just flat wrong.
And it stymies me. It stymies my husband and I have had this discussion about, what is the reason we stopped drilling oil in our own country, which would be a greener solution on so many levels it defies description. In your opinion, does it go back to the whole political lobbying, money issue, the interest? I mean, there are special interests with the oil companies. So what's your take on that? Why did we stop drilling in the United States when it would be a really cleaner, non-foreign-reliant energy source?
Well, our legal system, our political system, has essentially banned it in a lot of parts of the United States, and particularly on public lands and in the offshore regions. And so, you know, we've done that for environmental reasons and based on our concern about perfectly legitimate environmental issues, where we just, instead of solving the environmental problem by making sure we do it right, we let the pendulum swing too far the other way, and instead we just say none of this, none of that, and none of that. And as I said before, that does not supply the resources that our economy needs. And so instead, we import oil from all kinds of places in the world where we have no control over the environment at all and where we can't make them do it right. People are going to drive their cars, and I don't think you're going to convince people to stop doing that. So they're going to get oil from someplace. And in my mind, we can get it in the United States where we can control how it is done and make sure that it's done in an environmentally responsible way, or we can import it from someplace else. I think that's the two choices. And I know there are people out there who think, no, there's a third choice, which is that we should quit burning oil altogether. And I just say, sorry, it's pure fantasy. It's 90% of the energy that Americans use comes from oil and gas and coal. And we're not going to stop that in the next few years. We're going to phase it out, and we're going to continue to develop other sources of energy, and we should, but I'm not willing to sacrifice the standard of living that Americans have become accustomed to in order to make that happen. I'm just not. So, to me, let's do it right and care about the environment and stop making these phony political arguments instead.
And let's, everybody, we have less than 2 minutes left, which I can't even believe. We didn't get to the climate change. When you and I spoke earlier, we said this is about a five-hour show because you took on pretty much the most significant environmental issues facing us as a planet today in your book. And I want to do a shout out for you, if I may, again. If you are listening to this show and you really want to think and not have someone tell you what to think, you should get a copy of Greg's book. It'll get you in. It's not too scientific. It's not too data heavy, which loses me, Greg, to be quite honest. The name of his book is Smoking Them Out, The Theft of the Environment and How to Take It Back. And I really appreciate your honest thoughts with me today. And you've given me some things to think about because I love being Mrs. Green and I'm in a constant state of trying to make a difference. So, Greg, thanks. And
I appreciate you saying that. People can get it both in hardback and in the Nook and Kindle versions, by the way.
Okay, and Amazon.com. Just go and Google it and you'll find it. Thank you so much for being with us. Next week, another great show. Myra Goodman, founder of Earthbound Farms, one of the largest suppliers of organic produce in the country. Make it a great green week, everybody. And Greg, good luck with the sale of your book and, more importantly, your commitment to our environment. You're making a difference. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.